How many of you have gone to that really good talk last yesterday? You know, about the incident response? Oh, most of you. It was great. And it was actually fairly typical of an incident response scenario. And one of the things that you often find is that you have got all these different data sources. You know, you have log files, you have disk images, you have network images, and you would have seen how the girls have gone through and Tux's angels, you know, have gone through and basically put everything together and collected all these different kinds of evidence. And that's really what PyFlag is meant to do. It's meant to make it easier to put the different kinds of sources of information together so that we can correlate them together. And that's really the idea. So today I'm going to be talking about PyFlag and just give you a quick snapshot of current state of development. But in particular, I want to concentrate on how that can be used in an incident response scenario like we've seen yesterday. And before I start, I just have to thank my other co-author, David Collette, who has done a lot of work on it and helps maintain it and everything like that. So thanks very much. Now, today is going to be a hands-on tutorial. What I want to do is just go through some of the examples. And over here, we've got the IP address, if the list doesn't expire in the middle, we'll see how we go, where you can get some of those test images. Some of the larger images are pretty large. We'll get to them a little bit later, so you don't want to all download them at once. If you aren't able to download them today, because I'm not sure about the bandwidth and other things, they're all on the wiki, and you know, can be downloaded from the wiki. So, and this is the wiki. It's just pyflag.net, so if you want to do that later. So if you want to, you can work through some of the examples. You can install it. There's been a release made just yesterday. And so you know, it's got all the latest features, and we're going to try and run with the latest features, but it's like an RC, so it might break, but we'll see how we go. Basically, just a quick outline. We'll just do an introduction and installation. I'm not really going to dwell on this because you guys probably know how to do a configure, make install, so I'll just skip that. And then we'll just have a look at some of the log analysis stuff. And then we'll have a look at the disk forensics and see what can be done when we analyze disk images. And finally, we'll look at the network forensics and see how that fits within the PyFlag model and how that can be correlated with the disk and the logs. We'll touch a little bit about how to automate it. A lot of the forensic analysis tasks they take a long time. You have big images, you don't want it to be sitting there and interactively doing it. So much of this stuff is sort of scripted, and we'll have a look at some case studies. So we might not have actually too much time to delve into the case study, but the case study is actually available on the web and also to be downloaded from here. Now, if you go to that website the little web server over here, you would have seen all those images, and you have your server and the full dump, which are the case study. Okay. Well, you can do the case study using whatever tool, and you don't have to use PyFlag. It's just a case study with different, it's just basically a hack attempt. And it's kind of interesting to just have a bit of a play with that. So let's just go into why would I want to do forensics, forensics is not really only for law enforcement. Of course, we do that as part of law enforcement, but as an administrator, you may sometimes want to do a little bit of forensic investigation if you've got an intrusion on your network. If you've got something that you want to investigate on your network, you may want to investigate an employee that's perhaps misusing the network. You may want to investigate an intrusion, stuff like that. You might want to recover some files, even. A simple thing as recovering files, like if you accidentally push format on your flashcard and all your photos disappear. So that's a simple case of forensics. When we designed PyFlag, we actually had three major goals. The first one was to manipulate large quantities of data efficiently. And so because forensics usually involves massive quantities of data, large hard disks, large capture files, huge log files. And so we wanted to do that efficiently and consistently. So we use a database to store, MySQL database to store all the information. And that way it allows us to sort of do really quick queries and fairly sophisticated analysis on that data. And The second one was that we wanted to perform most of our analysis in advance. We wanted to be as scripted as possible because human time is very expensive for us, so we don't want to be sitting there waiting for it most of the time. We want to be able to do all the analysis in advance and then come back and just look at the results and analyze them. So we want it to be really responsive from an interactive point of view, but at the same time able to do some fairly sophisticated work. But finally, the most important property that we were going for is that every inference must be referenced by the evidence. So in other words, what that means is that you should be able to make any inference that you make using PyFlag, you should be able to go back to the hex editor and go, oh, okay, you know, at this offset, at this place, you know, there is this particular needle, and we didn't, you know, PyFlag helped us find it, but at the end of the day, you know, we can look, you use the hex editor and find it. So it's all very transparent. So we can see where everything came from and how we derived every result. So that way, you know, if we ever get contested, then it's not really an issue because you can always verify it from first principle. So today we'll be installing PyFlag from source. So basically, just you can download that from hp.pyflag.net or actually from the SourceForge mirror sites. And basically, it's just a very simple, you know, fairly standard sort of package. There's a few dependencies that you might need, like Python dev, it's written in Python, and libjpg and so on, but it will tell you as you try and configure it, it will say, oh, you know, I need this, I need that. Hopefully it will work. Okay, so basically, I'm just going to skip that step here, but essentially, you know, there's your make, you know, it's pretty straightforward. I already made that before. I just wanted to touch on the, when you first run it, it actually, it's just like a little wrapper that I used for running it. Okay. So when you first run it, it will actually tell you that that your installation is not configured, and it will allow you to configure it. So you run it, and then it will say something like, I can't connect to the database, you know, go to the website, to the web server, and configure the database thing. So you really need to kind of configure the database connection strings, the host name, the username, you know, the password, you know, things like that. Now, the other thing that you need to look at is the upload directory. So there's basically two major important directories in PyFlag. The upload directory is where it's going to allow you to get images from, because it's still a web application, so you can't just you know, give it full access to your file system, obviously from a security point of view. So the upload directory is where you need to put all those images that you want for it to load, and then you can, you know, it's not going to allow you to get anything outside of that directory. So it's just a way of containing it. The result directory is just a place for it to keep temporary files and so on throughout the operation. So it's just somewhere that it should be able to write. Okay. So for our purposes, we will use the GeoIP service from XMind. So for a lot of the IP GeoIP locations, we use the XMind service. It's free. It's actually a Debian package, apt-get install GeoIP. Bin, and it brings in a very small sort of database. You can actually download a slightly bigger database from their website for free, and you can just buy it as well. So you'll find over here there is actually the free database, which is a little bit bigger than the one that comes in Debian, and so you can actually download that and put it wherever you like. The other interesting properties of PyFlag is the command line, you know, help dash dash help, and just bless it. And what it does here is it actually tells you all the parameters that you can set and the default values. So it actually tells you what it's set to as well. So you can, if you are not sure what configuration file it's reading or whatever, you can just do a dash dash help and see what it's set to, and so on. So basically, variety of different things in there. Okay. So it rereads the configuration file before it does the help, in other words, so it's quite useful for that. Okay, so basically, I'm just going to skip the install because I'm sure you can all do a make install. All right, so why would we want to analyze logs? Well, a lot of the time, when you're analyzing logs, you're really looking to answer some questions. You're not just going to look at a $260 million line log file, you know, with millions of lines of it, and just, you know, look at it. It's just not going to work because there's just too many rows. It's just not physically possible. So normally, when you're actually looking at that, you need to answer some questions. You're actually looking to answer some of your questions, and your questions might not even be forensically related or incident response related. There might be a simple question of like, who was using our site? Where did they come from? What were they interested in? So marketing sort of questions. Or there might be something like, how did an intrusion occur? Who accessed these PHP pages that were vulnerable? Where did they come from? How did they, you know, access it? At what time? And so on. So it might be. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that you really always, you almost always, after some piece of information that you already know, it will be useful for you, and you're just trying to dig it out and summarize it. So you don't really look at the log file sequentially. And you can sort of use grep a lot of the time. You know, you can grep out the lines that you're interested in. But for some of the more complex queries, that's just not possible. Like, for instance, if you say, okay, you know, I want to know all the IP addresses that came from Germany, so you can't really grep for that. You know, you have to sort of do some more interesting analysis. So that's really what PyFlag sort of allows you to do. So, and of course, there are lots of log analysis packages which are specifically designed for a specific task, like a web administration, webmin, and other things like that. But PyFlag is sort of more general for everything. The other problem that comes up when you analyze log files is that there are different kinds of log files, different kind of formats. So, for example, Apache logs are different from IIS logs. They're different from, you know, IP tables logs. They're different from syslogs. They all have a slightly different format. There's no standard. There's no. It's not a lot of the time. It's not really easy to machine parse them as well. And also, even the same application can produce different logs from different formats. So, for instance, Apache can produce arbitrary formats logs, you know, according to directives that you put in the config file. And, you know, when you come to analyze a particular server, it really depends on how it was configured. Sometimes it's configured with a standard sort of format. Sometimes it's been customized or tweaked or changed a little bit. So it's very hard to parse. So you really need a tool that is adaptable that you can just sort of change to parse the different formats. So what we want to do is we want to make it easy for the users to import any log file format by allowing them to define a preset, what we call a preset. So preset is sort of like a template that allows you to, that just tells PyFlag how to parse this particular log file. And you can use that preset for any file from that source. So basically, so if you have a particular server that's been configured to log in a particular format or a particular way, then you create a preset for that, and then forevermore you can go back to that server and use that template, that preset, to load the files from. And then basically we allow you to do all the natural language queries, and the database does all the heavy lifting in the background. And basically a log driver is a plugin that allows you to handle a whole class of log files. Like there's an Apache driver which allows you to do all kinds of Apache things. And then we configure that driver and give it special parameters to tweak it to a specific instance to create the preset. So here's an example. We're going to do an exercise here. And this particular exercise is with the IIS standard image, so you can download and have a play. And basically, the first thing we might want to do is just create a new case. Essentially, that just makes some web. It creates a database for us to put stuff in, so it's kind of useful. Then, if we go to the log analysis menu and we create a log preset, that allows us to basically create that template that we're going to use for IIS or whatever. So with IIS, for instance, it's a very simple log file format, and it's actually fairly nice. It's quite well machine parsable, so it's very simple to parse. It's a CSV file, basically, and it's got the headers. And the first line is a header, which basically tells you what all the columns are. So it's pretty standard, and it's pretty easy to parse it, the IIS one. So we're going to sort of do that first. So in order to build a template, we need like a sample file to look at. You know, we need something to guide us, if you like. So we're going to click on this upload directory, which allows us to grab the file out of the upload directory, and then we're going to click on that IIS standard log, and that selects that log file. And we're going to go next. Okay, and then, but what So basically, with the IIS log file, there's enough information in the log file itself to work out what the format is by itself. But with Apache, there isn't, because there's no headers, and there's no format specification, because that's sort of in a config file, and it's tweakable, and so forth. So the IIS driver just sort of makes a best guess effort. It sort of guesses what it sort of might look like. And what it tries to do is it basically tries to insert a few rows into the table to sort of show you, okay, you know, is that reasonable? Does that look all right? And this is what we're getting here. So basically it's saying to us, okay, you know, I've guessed the file format and this is what it looks like. And so what we need to look at is we need to say, okay, the timestamps are all right, they're legitimate. The IP addresses look okay, you know, the username and method and so forth. So these are all the different parameters. So you would have seen that basically it knows about the different types. So it knows what things are. It's not just a string. It's not treating everything as just a string. So, for example, with the timestamp, this is actually a timestamp, a database timestamp. So it's a proper time, and you can do time operations on it and other things like that. You can see there's a little clock next to it. You can add it to a timeline and, you know, and work with that. With the IP address, it knows it's an IP address. And in fact, it just goes off and does a geolocation for you, just down here. There's a little flag and tells you, okay, I actually have the full Maxmind, you know, the one you have to pay for, database loaded on this. So it tells you a lot of information that you might want to know. Like, for example, you know, if it's a proxy address or if it's a, you know, where it is and what country and so forth. And this is actually quite useful because Maxmind updated all the time. They keep tab of all the open proxies or as many open proxies as possible. And quite often you look at your log file and you do a query like, show me the ones from open proxies, and it's going to be like pretty obvious who the bad guys are. So, you know, because most of them will go through a Tor proxy or something. Okay, and then basically, you know, we've got our URL and so forth. So basically, this looks pretty good. We're going to go, yep, cool, that's fine. Now, if the file wasn't quite right, we would see some errors there, and then we might have to go and build it by hand using some of the other drivers. So we're going to give it a name. We're going to call it IIS or whatever. Yeah, doesn't matter. And now we've got this template. And if we had the machine name, we might use that machine name. So whenever we get a log file from that machine in the future, we could just use that template on it. We don't have to go through this process. It's not a big process for IIS, but it could be a fairly big one for other ones. Okay, and then basically we're going to weblog. We're going to create a new one, and we're going to select that file again. So the first time we selected it was when we built the preset. And what that did is it allowed us to just, you know, have a test file, a small file that we're just playing with. And now we're actually loading the real file. I mean, so you might have a huge file here or something different. Now, we select that. We're using that preset so it knows how to load them. That's great. We can do a pre-filter expression. So, for instance, that actually applies a filter before the table is loaded. So it reduces the number of rows in the database and makes your queries faster. So if there's an obvious filter that you can apply to just eliminate, you know, most of the traffic that, you know, like if you have traffic to static pages and you're not interested in that, you could just say, you know, URL doesn't contain, you know, HTML or something, and then just remove the HTML pages. It's not interesting because they're all static probably. So you can reduce the data set and then your analysis is much more efficient. So you can do that, but basically we're just going to load them all for this case. It's only a very small table, so we'll just go. We click on that tick and go submit, and it's going to go off and upload all these things. It gives us a little bit of a progress bar there, and you know, I mean, that might take a while. I mean, if you have millions and millions of lines, you know, that might take a while. And okay, so we're going to browse it, and all it does is it doesn't really do anything fancy. It just throws it all into one big table for you. There it is, just one big table. The same thing as what we've seen before with a sample table, but it just does it for all the rows, so all the rows are in there. So we can actually talk a little bit about this table, because this table is actually all the analysis that it does, and it's all the analysis you need, because it allows you to do a lot of very powerful things, this table widget, and it's used everywhere. So let's just have a look a little bit at the toolbar up here, and I'll just try and zoom in a little bit. Okay, so it's going to be interesting. Yeah. Okay, so we can see, for instance, that we have a few toolbars at the top here. You've got the left arrow, we've got the right arrow. So that just allows you to page. So there's like 50 rows per table and you're paging through it, one page, another page. And the reason for that is there could be millions and millions of rows, you know, in the table. So you don't want to be displaying them all at once, obviously. So you can just sort of page, next page, so forth. It tells you sort of what rows you're on, stuff like that. So that's pretty obvious. That's straightforward. That thing allows you to just jump straight into a particular row. Like if you know a number, just go to 1,000, row 1,000, whatever. So that's just a little helper. And that's the most important one, the filter. That allows you to set filters, which is what we're going to talk about next. So we already mentioned that PyFlag actually knows the data type, the type that it is stored inside the table. It's not not necessarily a database. It doesn't reflect necessarily to a database type. It actually works out what's the most efficient database type to store this thing and how do you store it and all this sort of stuff. So it's basically an abstraction of how you store stuff in databases. So basically, you know, for that timestamp, it knows, for instance, it's a timestamp. For the IP address, it knows it's an IP address. So when you open up the filter table dialog box, which allows you to filter it, then basically you can put in a natural language query. For instance, you can say something like IP address, you know, from GeoIP country, you know, USA or whatever. And so what that means is it's going to show us all of the American IP addresses, for instance. And then again, it uses that GeoIP location database to do that. So it doesn't necessarily translate into a direct SQL query. It just kind of works it out, and it might do a very complicated operation, like a join or whatever. You know, it doesn't matter really. From a user perspective, it's just a pretext sort of query to say, okay, you know, I want you to do this. So, for instance, in this case, what we're doing is we're only seeing the American IP addresses. Not really picking on Americans, but just this is what we want to look at. And you know, we might say something like, and you can see over here we have a status bar. And you know, for those of you that, for example, we have, you know, a download, not the number of bytes, let's say. And so we want to see all the American addresses that click on that again. And we can keep going with that. We can go like and SE bytes, you know, greater than 1,000, let's say. You know, and that's, so that just kind of joins them together, and you can add more and more filters to that thing. And so that allows you to kind of drill down into the table and then start to look at different things. So you can see, you know, over here, you know, we're seeing the larger downloads, not the little ones. So that might be useful for a certain investigation. So we're just going to clear that. That just, when you have a filter, you click on that, that clears it, so you don't have a filter anymore. And sometimes, as you can see in this one, the table is quite wide, and it doesn't all fit, so we can just sort of hide a few columns, and, you know, we might not be interested in the method, you know, or URI, or status, or whatever, you know, we just remove things. So it just kind of, you know, puts things a little bit better. Over here, we've got the ability to, I'll just put that back. And basically, over here, we've got the ability to export it. So a lot of people just want to, you know, export it into a CSV file from the database. So you click on that, and basically, it says, okay, you know, which tables do you want to export, which columns, you know, and how do you want to do it? How many rows do you want to export, all of them, or just a few, or whatever? And basically, whatever filtering you've applied, I mean, that's what's this exporting, right? So you can go from a really large log file, filter it right down, you know, to a small subset of important things, and then export those ones, and then you've got it in CSV format. I mean, some people like to use Excel, I don't know why, but for some reason they feel more comfortable with that, so that's what it's there for. But it's useful to export it. This next thing is basically a group by type operator, but what group by means for those of you that aren't familiar with the database SQL sort of language, a group by basically means to count the number of identical items in each column. So basically, if you look at a particular column, and for example, just get rid of that. So for instance, if you look at here, you see how there's a number of items which have the same value, 226 as a status code, and group by just counts how many are of each thing, of each item. So, I'm sorry? Unique items, yeah, and how many of each unique item, yeah. So for instance, if we look at a status, you know, that just tells us, okay, you know, there are, you know, 7,000 entries over 226. You know, there are 9 entries over 225 and so on. And that is quite useful from, you can see how that could be useful because, for instance, in here, a 40, you know, a 226 is a continue code, right? So it's obviously used to download. There's a lot of downloads. There's a 425, which is unauthorized or something like that. And so, and there's a 550, which is a machine, like an internal error or whatever. So that often happens when a PHP script, you know, might get exploited. It might have an error within it, and the server is terminating that. So the different error codes are useful for different things. If you want to know how many 404s are there on a web page, you know, then you can count that and then basically narrow them down. So if you actually click on that, that's just like a quick way of basically going through and adding that filter condition in. And in fact, if we have a look at that little thing, let me just zoom in a bit. Yeah. So you see that the filter that it's adding is SE status equals 550. It's just a quick way of doing that. And we could just keep doing that over and over, basically narrow it down and apply filters and so on. So for instance, you know, out of all the 550s, you know, we see there's a number of different usernames, and we might want to, you know, group by username, you know, and then that filter is still applied. So what this is showing us is the number of unique entries for each username that have the same, you know, that have a 505 status, right? So it just kind of drills in like that. So basically, and the last one is count, which basically just tells us how many rows there are, just a big count. And, you know, it sometimes can be expensive to do that count because you're still doing an SQL query and you might still be doing a full table scan. So that's why, you know, it's a special sort of operator that you don't do all the time, but you might want to do it sometimes to just see how many there are all up. So it's a fairly straightforward one. Now you see that table widget is basically used everywhere, you know, pretty much everywhere. So once you know how to use it, you can basically use it in everything. It's a very simple, from a usability perspective, it's very consistent, so you can just sort of go through that. Okay. All right, so that's the log analysis. Basically, you can do all sorts of other drivers and create different presets with different... There's one that allows you to just, you know, add regular expressions, so you can actually do like pretty powerful presets and so on. Okay, so this is basically what we've been through. We've just been through now. Okay, and we can see that we can filter it. We can do things like net masks as well, you know, where we can actually go, you know, it's within that net mask and so forth. And the basic structure of the filter string is just column operator action. So, you know, column, the operator that applies to it, and then the action. So, you know, an example of timestamp after a certain time and, you know, timestamp before that, and the IP address is that, and, you know, it can get complicated. Okay, grouping, we've been through that, and grouping's been after filtering. Okay, now there is a thing here about the advanced log driver, which allows you to build more flexible logs. And, well, I'm just going to skip that, basically, because it's in here anyway, and basically what you have to write is in here, so you can sort of do that later. But, because we kind of need to move on. All right, so basically that's log analysis. And with that part, it was a good introduction to the whole GUI and how to use it. So that's log analysis, and now we want to do some disk forensics. And basically, a disk forensics might mean that you might go to a hard disk, a computer, take out the hard disk, image the hard disk, and then you're trying to analyze the hard disk for something. You're trying to look for something in a hard disk. And there's lots of different reasons that you might want to do that. For example, you might want to search an employee has left the company, and you know, basically you want to know whether he had in his possession, you know, some documents, IP, intellectual property, that sort of thing, you know, before he left, that sort of thing. Customer lists, things like that. So you can actually go and do this, and this is a fairly common sort of computer forensics sort of thing. and basically, there's lots of different ways of imaging the disk. There's commercial packages to do it. There's DD. You know, DD is a simple one because you just, you know, use DD and DD the raw device. And there's hardware devices as well that do it, like a Logicube and other things like that. So there's, and then they all have different image formats. The DD one is simple because it's just a raw image and you can mount it through loopback. But and I think that's what was used yesterday in the instant response talk. But there are some proprietary file formats, like Encase is a very common forensic system for Windows, and it uses its own proprietary format to do that. And there are lots of other ways, like there's RAID. You know, you might image a RAID where you need to reassemble the disks together. So basically, there's lots of different formats of hard disk images, and then there's also lots of different file systems as well. So there's some NTFS file systems, there's EXE file systems, other ones like that. So basically, what we want to do is we want to really use the same tool on all these different things. So in PowerFlag, we have the concept of an I/O source, which is basically a way of abstracting the image file format. So there is a thing called an I/O source driver, which is a piece of code which basically abstracts this the actual image format. And basically, there's different drivers. There's ones that just do a simple pass-through, like a DD image. One, there's Encase images, which supports that proprietary format. There is the ones that split, so they automatically join the DD images together, which is fairly common when you do it using a hardware device. Ones that are using RAID, and then there's SGZip, which is a compressible format that we use. And basically, that sort of abstracts the image type, and then we just use it from in the same way. So, and then there's lots of different kinds of file systems. And basically, file systems are fairly intricately married to forensic packages, because people are really familiar with that, and it maps really easily. So there's directories and files, and people are sort of used to going through a directory tree and selecting files. And it's a really good model because it's a sort of a tree view, and you can see all sorts of information that's related to each other. So we actually use that sort of model to display a lot of the information, but we extend it in a sort of abstract way. We use what's called a virtual file system. So the file system never really exists. It's just in the database. It's got a database representation of a tree view. And essentially, it's like a real file system in the sense that the VFS has a concept of an inode, which is basically a way of accessing that information. And it's got, and inodes have file names and paths and stuff like that. So it's similar to that. But basically, the difference is that the inode, what we term as the inode, is basically a way or a description of how we actually get to that data. And I'll give you an example to make it a bit simpler to illustrate. So here's what an inode would look like in PyFlag. So we actually have a notation that we represent the inode. And essentially, what that means is that you see that it has a number of different components and are separated by pipes. And what it means is that we have separate different file drivers or different handlers for each of those components. And then the output of each one is being put into the input of the next one, so to speak. And so that actually describes to us how we're able to access, how we can access that information. That goes back to that design criteria that I mentioned, that all the evidence is directly referenced back, because whenever we see anything in PyFlag, it will have an inode, and we can just read it and see how we actually got to that information. So for instance, in this example, the first item is INET. So I is basically the prefix that we use for an I/O source, and we name an I/O source. So this particular one is named NET. So basically, it just gives us the image, the name of the image that we're going to use. So we know that's the image. Now that image is being passed into the next one, which is the stream reassembler. So we know that because of the S, and it tells us that it's a stream reassembler. And that stream reassembler is going to take, you know, the fourth and the fifth stream out of it. So this is a PCAP file, obviously. And then that stream is going to be reassembled in chronological order. So that's what the S tells us. Then that stream is then fed into another driver, which is an offset driver, which is telling us because of that O. And at a certain offset, 456 bytes into the stream, we're going to take a chunk out of it. It's about 30 Ks long. And then that chunk of data is then passed into the next driver along, which is the M driver, which is a MIME decoder for MIME. And that is actually an email. So it's going to go off and decode that email. And the first attachment out of that is pulled out, and then that attachment then is passed on to the next driver along, which is the T driver, which is a tar driver. And the second file in our tar file is what we are actually interested in. So you see that, so that I/O basically represents a path of how we use to actually obtain that file. That file is actually being transmitted on the network, right? In a, probably an SMTP or a POP connection or something like that. And those packets are reassembled into a string first of all, then they're being decoded, and then basically we pull out a chunk of this whole stream, we decode that as a MIME header, we pull out the attachment, and then there's a tar file, and then we open that tar file, and yes?
To get all of those parameters there, then pretty much
analysis. Right, exactly. Yeah, so basically the analysis goes off and finds these things, and then it shows you these ones, and then you can read that, how to actually derive that data. But yeah, how to actually come up with those numbers, of course you have to go and do the searching, and we'll go into that in a minute. But it does that automatically and in a lot of cases. So we can actually, this is basically goes back to how we actually can find it from first principles just by looking at that concept. I'll show more of an example in a minute so we get the feel of it more. Okay, so just one last concept before we go into a demo, because that will make things quite a bit clearer once we actually start using it. The other thing is that a file system driver. So we already talked about the fact that there are lots of different file systems. There's NTFS, EXT2, and other ones as well. And so a file system driver is just a piece of software that allows us to look at that file system and go, okay, you know, I can find all these files in that file system and then build up the VFS from that. So we can basically, if you have an EXT2 file system driver, it can open the EXT2 file system, find all the files and directories, and then it will build inside the VFS a copy of those files and directories so it looks the same. We'll see how that differs. So there's lots of different file system drivers, and some of them are not even really file systems. They're just kind of a way of putting things into the VFS. For instance, like there is a PCAP file system, which we'll talk about in a minute, which basically allows us to load PCAP files into this virtual file system. And it's not really a file system at all, but it's just a pseudo file system driver for the VFS. Okay, so okay, before we go to that, we'll just give a quick demo. So basically, what we'll do is, all right, we'll go over here, and we'll go to load. So the first thing is we might want to load an I/O source. We're going to load a disk image now, just for a simple thing. Now, there's a number of different disk images, and there's different I/O subsystem drivers. So the different drivers allow us to load the images in different formats, so they can handle different formats of images. There's a mounted I/O subsystem, which allows us to use just a mounted directory, and that's useful for cases where we don't have forensic capability against that file system. For instance, HFS Plus is fairly complicated, and we don't have a forensic capability against it, but we can just mount it over the kernel, and so we can just mount it in the directory and use that. It's not as good because we can't recover deleted files, lag space, and things like that, but it's something, right? So it's good. Advanced is basically just a standard DD sort of file system, but it allows you to kind of use joint DDs and so forth. And EWF is the eyewitness, which is the NCASE file format. We're going to choose EWF because that's not a bad file format. And then basically the upload directory. We open it up, and what we're going to use is this one, which is a PyFlex standard image, which is just an image that we use from our unit test suite. So it's got all sorts of kind of files and things like that. So it's good to demonstrate. So we'll just open it up like that. Now, of course, EWF files can have lots of different parts in them. So they have E01, E02, E04, E03, and so forth. Now, that image is actually a disk image, okay? And so there's going to be a partition table in the front of it. And so we don't really know what the partition table is. So we have to enter a partition offset, and if we click on this thing, it's going to read the partition table for us and show us all the different partitions on the disk, right? And where they start and when they end, stuff like that. And it's sort of up to us to decide. It's kind of all it does is it just fills in that offset. And so we can see that there is a FAT32 partition right here, and there is a Linux partition right here, which is what we're going to choose. So we're going to choose the Linux one, And it's basically telling us that it's 16,128 sectors into the disk, so that's what that S means. But you can use kilobytes, megabytes, whatever, doesn't matter. And then basically we're going to call it a name. So this is the unique data load ID. It's just a name that we're going to call it. So it could be Fred's disk. We're going to call it Fred. You know, it's some way that we know what that, where that evidence comes from, so that Python will continue to refer to it by that name in the inodes and everything like that. So here we go. We're going to call it Fred, and this could be Fred's disk, for example. And basically, PyFlag is looking at it and it's saying, oh, okay, look, I think it's a ext2 file system, which is not surprising because it was a Linux partition. And it's recommending that we use the sleuthkit to load that. So the sleuthkit is a tool written by Brian Carrier, and it's basically a fairly common forensic tool, and it's integrated into PyFlag. And so that's probably the best tool for this one. And then it's basically given us the option here of a mount point on the VFS. Where do we want to put it in the VFS? The VFS is virtual, and it's sort of like mounting it. So we're going to call it Fred, slash Fred, which is because that's Fred's hard disk. And then if we had a number of hard disks and some network traffic and other things, we can put them all in the same case in different mount points, and then we can do correlation. So we'll do that in a minute. But basically what you see, it's gone off and it's created a virtual file system, and we can navigate that. So we've got a, of course it's very quick because it's only a really small image, but it's basically a standard navigational sort of thing. We can look through it and, you know, open things up and that sort of thing. So over here, for instance, we have, you know, a couple of zip files. You can see there's a few JPEGs, you know, whatever. So there's a few things in here. Now, here, this is a table view of exactly the same thing. And again, it's the same widget, the same table widget that we used before, so we can do all kinds of searching. We can say, okay, you know, show me all the files that end in JPEG and they have a bigger, you know, they're bigger than this size and happened, you know, and the modified time is after that time and before that time, and we can really get carried away. So that's basically straightforward. Now, this is, so far, it's not really that useful because we could have just mounted that and looked at it, so it's not really a big deal. So, but here, this is the point where we actually start to understand what we're actually trying to do here, and this is where we understand how we get to those inodes that we talked about before. So obviously you need to actually analyze this file system to actually try and dig out all these files that are included within it. And the way that we do that in PyFlag is we call it scanning. So we scan the file system, and there's all kinds of scanners, and scanners are just little bits of code that are familiar with doing certain things. They're designed to look for a certain kind of file or something like that. So for instance, there's a zip scanner that knows all about zip files. You know, knows how to open them, how to look inside, all this sort of stuff. And then there's a PST scanner that knows all about PST files. And, index scanner that does indexing, IE cache, knows about all IE history files, stuff like that. So basically all of these scanners are used to go through and find different things. And they are the ones that actually create inodes in the VFS that corresponds to those files that they found. So basically, the scanners are the way to populate the VFS. Yes? I'm sorry?
Sorry, I was just going to ask how it handles encrypted files.
Oh, we don't. No, we don't handle it. I'm sorry. The question was, how do we handle encrypted files? We don't actually handle encrypted files at the moment. Obviously, the crypt analysis is beyond the scope of this, but. Well, if it's encrypted, like say if it's an encrypted zip file, it's going to try and open it, and it's going to say, well, in case of a zip file, you can still see the directory structure, but the files are going to come out rubbish, you know. So you're just going to go, okay, you know, we just got this random blob of garbage, and that's where it's going to stop. But so it was, yes? No, we use libpst. There's no real support. Yeah, I don't believe that there is actually any open source support for anything after that, which is a shame, really. I mean, there needs to be some work done on that. Yeah. Sorry, the question was, does it work with PST files which are post 2003, Outlook 2003? And there is no actual open source support for that file format. There's only open source support for before 2003. So, yeah. unfortunately. Okay, so basically, I'll just quickly go through and show you what I mean, and it might jail in sort of what the point is. So basically, we loaded the file system, and here it is. And now we're going to click on this thing, which will allow us to scan it. So we'll go scan file system. Okay, and basically it's telling us, okay, a global or a path, so we can scan from slash, or we can scan just a subdirectory of that. We don't have to scan the whole thing. And basically over here it's giving us these are categories, different categories of scanners. And when we open each category, it tells us all the gory details. But generally speaking, the scanner will be enabled if it's useful and not too slow. But if the scanner is too slow and is not used that much, then it's usually disabled by default. And you can turn it on if you want, but basically, so things like carving and compressed file support is usually turned off by default because it's a little bit, it might be slower, but we're going to turn it on just to get, because it's a small image. And off we go. So basically, it's telling us how many jobs are pending. We're going to talk about that later. So basically, it goes off, it basically does a scan of all the files. And the other thing is that when it finds a zip file, it will actually create VFS inodes for entries with that zip file. But then it will actually scan those as well. So for instance, if there are zip files inside zip files or whatever, then it actually goes through, and that's how it recurses through things. So to give you an example, we have this file here, which is the test.txt, and that's the content of it. So that's telling us, okay, so the tooltip comes up like that. It's the thread image, when we're passing to it the K is the sleuth kit, and it basically tells us the inode as far as the sleuth kit is concerned. So that actually corresponds to a real file system inode, and then basically that's passed into the gzip file driver that just gzips it, basically unzips it, and so there's your text file. And there's a variety of different file formats. Here's another example, that PST file, which again was so, and then you can see that there's a virtual file system entry for the deleted files. Sometimes when you recover deleted files, you don't know what their file name is. You just find the inode. But the file is actually intact, but you have no idea, where it came from. So this is just a way of kind of, it's like a lost and found in a sense. It puts them all the files that it doesn't know their file names, puts them all in the same spot. So it allows you to see all the deleted ones as well. And over here we've got unallocated files, which are just contiguous bits of unallocated space, which it just sort of groups them together. All right, so basically, what I wanted to do now is, you can have a bit of a play, and we'll have a bit of a break, about 10 minutes, did you say?